And welcome, Andrew.
Thank you very much. First of all, isn't that a cute dog? Yes, very cute. That's our little dog, Nessie, at home. It's a new photo. So, let's see. So, this is sort of an impromptu talk. When I was submitting talks for this year's Sambra XP, I really thought I should talk about all the legal stuff because I've been bound up as, you know, pretending to be a lawyer so much the last year. But I really wanted to do something technical too, so, and I discovered there was a spare slot because somebody wasn't presenting, so I offered to grab the slot. So it's a bit impromptu, but there has been a lot happening in the last year in clustered Sambra. You already heard some of it from the presentation from Alexander Wolf on the what's been done with the SOFS, which is IBM's commercialization and productization of this work. But I wanted to tell you a little bit about what's been going on the sort of Sambra internal side and the work that Ronnie and myself have been doing. Ronnie's here. Yeah. Oh, there you are. Ronnie Salberg over there. So a lot of the work that I'm going to be claiming credit for was actually Ronnie's work in the last year, and also Volker and Stefan Metzemacher and a whole lot of people here at the conference have been contributing to this clustered Sambra work. And basically the theme is clustered Sambra is not just a hack anymore. This time last year, clustered Sambra was a rigged demo. It was possible, we gave a demo and the demo sort of worked, but it really was very marginal as to whether anyone could actually run it. This year, there are now production sites running this. There are television stations at various places, I can't tell you, around the world where, you know, stuff gets streamed off clustered Sambra to you know, send out their TV signals. So it's a reel now. And so the theme of this is about is what's happened in the last year, what new features, a little bit of a talk about what the basic idea is for those of you who didn't see the talk on clustered Sambra last year. Please interrupt this talk and, you know, heckle and ask for explanations or whatever. I don't mind getting diverted in any way you like into other interesting topics. So please do that. Okay, so at Sambra XP last year, we described CTDB, which is this new lightweight clustered database. We gave a hacked up demo of CTDB running, and it did sort of work, I think. And this year, it's now deployed in production at multiple locations, and it's ready for you to use. So you can start deploying clustered Sambra now if you want to. And let's have a look. Okay, so I was going to show some demos. Now, the plan was that I would actually demonstrate live running the system. When I'm in Australia, strangely enough, the demo cluster I use is in Germany. But when I'm in Australia, I then have a latency from Australia to Germany showing, and it's just marginal to show demos in Australia. Unfortunately, the demo cluster is on the IBM network. The only way I can get into the IBM network is to bounce packets off Australia. So when I'm in Germany, to demonstrate this cluster, the packets have to go to Australia, then back to Germany. And I tried it with the demos this morning, it was unworkable. So last year, what I did was I used a German IBM as account and bounced the packets directly. Unfortunately, Sven isn't here and his password's changed, so I can't do that. You didn't hear that. So I can't do that. And so what I'm going to be doing is showing you movies pre-recorded taken from Australia of using a German cluster. So anyway, we'll do that now. So I've got a couple of movies here and... and movies, CTDB movies. So what the movies I'm going to show are, so that I can do this, I'm going to show a few different movies. And unfortunately, Ronnie, I couldn't find the 1.7 gigabyte per second movie. It's not on my laptop. Anyway, we'll just have to believe it. We got a demo of achieving 1.7 gigabytes a second with SMB. Sustained throughput, yeah, with SMB. And so anyway, the movie of that demo showing that it actually works was on Ronnie's laptop, and I thought I had a copy here, and I don't, and I only just noticed that just when I was in the previous talk listening to the Likewise stuff and installing Likewise. Anyway, so what I'm going to demonstrate is fast IP failover. snapshot exposure, offline file handling. We might get around to online software upgrade and maybe crash resilience, but I mightn't necessarily do that in that order. I'll just explain roughly what each one is. So fast IP failover, imagine you've got a cluster. We've got a cluster of four nodes, right? Linux x86 64-based nodes they happen to be. And they've got an underlying cluster file system, the GPFS cluster file system in this case, right? But it should work with GFS2. And Stephen Zarkos from, where's Stephen? Who's here? Look there. He's been testing apparently with GFS2 inside Microsoft with this clustered Samba stuff, which is great. And I've been doing some tests with Lustre at the ANU Lustre system as well. And so it does work with multiple cluster file systems. All of the production deployments are with the GPFS file system from IBM at the moment. But I'm hoping that one of you might go away from this and start a production deployment with, you know, another cluster file system and then report back how wonderfully it works. So fast IP failover, you've got this four node cluster, you've got a bunch of windows. Yeah, question. Has to be coherent. It has to have coherent locking, but it actually only needs one lock. And so the ones that meet the basic requirements are GFS2, Lustre, GPFS. We've got a web page that describes a set of test tools you need to run against a cluster file system to validate whether it behaves correctly. And if you look on ctdb.samba.org, it points off at the wiki, it points off some tools on how to validate it. The problem is that a lot of cluster file systems ostensibly have the features, if you look at their feature list, they need. But if you try these tools, it crashes the file system, right? And that of course, that happened with GPFS and GFS2 and Lustre when we first tried it. And all of them have now been fixed, so these tools no longer crash these file systems. Yep. Yes, some of them are extremely slow, and again, these tools will give you some performance metrics. It's a very, very simple tool. There's a couple of hundred lines of C that does some nasty things that cluster file systems hate, and these tools will tell you roughly how it does. So if you've got some other cluster file system that you've got in mind, have you got a particular one in mind? Or
OCFS2
1.4. OCFS2.
1.4.
Yeah, it doesn't have coherent locking at all.
It has.
Oh, it's been added. Oh, brilliant. Can you try it? Have you got an OCFS2 cluster to give it a whirl on?
No, not accessible, but we will try.
Yeah, please try. And then update the wiki to then say how it works and what options you need. We have got some specialized options in clustered Samba to cope with some of the idiosyncrasies of different cluster file systems. Because some of them, a good example, we can get a little bit technical, devices and inodes. In the Unix world, a lot of programmers assume that when you stat a file, the device and the inode of the file uniquely identifies the file, right? Now, on a lot of cluster file systems, that's true most of the time, but sometimes it isn't. In particular, depending on what can happen to, say, GPFS, is that as long as you've only got one cluster file system mounted on all the nodes, they'll probably all have the same device number. And so you test your program and it's all okay. Then the customer has two or three cluster file systems running at the same time, and they happen to mount in a different order on the different nodes, and the device ID ends up different on the different nodes, and so it actually confuses the files between the different nodes. And so Samba then internally, its locking databases are keyed off these device and inode numbers, and you can imagine the chaos when a file on one file system is thought to be the same file as a file on a completely different file system, right? Absolute chaos. And so we've got options in Samba to cope with that by mapping per node from the file system, the device ID up to the file system name, and then mapping that across the cluster so it treats it in the databases by file system name and inode rather than device ID. Those are the sort of hacks you've got to do, and you've got to be very, very careful to get those right with the new cluster file system. Otherwise, it might seem to work until your customer rings you up and said, we've just lost all our data, right? And then you get unhappy. So it's well worth running these tests and ensuring that, you know, that it actually gets it right. Okay, things like offline file handling, that's for integration with hierarchical storage managers, where files are pushed out to tape and you've got to do special stuff in order to integrate Windows clients with that. Snapshotting exposure, exposing advanced features in file systems like snapshots to the Windows client as shadow copies. And okay, so that's some of the demos. So let's go here. And what I'm going to do, Gdash minus one, and I'm just going to see, so CTDB, let's see, what do we want? No disable. SWF. So this is just going to show a demo. Now, I do have sound here of me giving a commentary, but I didn't plug in. Can we actually plug in the microphone sound thing? Or should I can redo the commentary live. What I'll do is I'll...
Hold your microphone down to the speaker. It works. You did that yesterday.
Really?
Yeah, that's how the
box works. OK, what I might do is I might redo the commentary over the top. It's probably clearer anyway. So what this is going to do, I hope, is this is now a Windows XP machine in Germany. I'm doing recording all this from Australia. This is our cluster. We've just done a netuse to demonstrate that we're sharing this. I'll just pause this for a second while I explain. Why isn't this bringing up the menu? File, edit. Huh? What about movie control, pause. OK, maybe I'll just pause it. Sorry, it's a different menu structure. Just upgraded Gnash. I was using Clash before. Anyway, so what this is doing, this is mounted. So we see that //salp/data1. Right? This is named in honor of Alexander Salp, who installed this cluster. So it's the Salp cluster. Notice it's a single name. So the one name identifies all the nodes in the cluster. So in this case, there's four nodes in the cluster, and that one name, and the name gets round-robin DNS in this particular case onto the four IP addresses where each node has its own IP address, and then it's accessing a share, and we've mapped that to the drive letter Z. And then what we're doing is just looking at a directory listing over there, and I'm about to start a file copy, and so let's play this again, right? So what it's going to be doing is copying a whole bunch of files. So we can see here that it's just copying from one directory to another. Now, it's not using the server-side copy file stuff, right? It's actually the data is going via the Windows client in this case. So it's a good exercise of it just doing a whole lot of I.O. And now what we're going to do, we're going to have a look at which node that client is attached to with SMB status. And we can see that he's attached to node 3. Now, that's I'll pause that for a second and explain. SMB status, you've probably all seen SMB status if you run Samba before. The first column shows, with minus N, it shows the process ID that a particular user is using. So it shows all the people who are attached and their process ID. In a cluster, it's a node process ID pair, right? So this is node number 3, if I move the mouse a little bit. The mouse was in the recording. The mouse thing, node number 3, process ID 30780, and their username and group, and it isn't mapping them to the Active Directory ones. It's with WinBind and Active Directory because I've done minus N, so give me numeric. And so it's attached, it's from this machine, which is the Windows client, FSCC HS21-3, which is that Windows client there. So he's attached to node 3, and then while the copy is happening, so we're live copying a bunch of files, what we're going to do is disable that node. So we're going to administratively disable that node. So we're going to be polite to it and say, we don't want that node anymore. Okay. So it's going to go CTDB disable minus N3, right? And that disables that node in the cluster. And I'm going to hit enter eventually. This is my commentary now going on while which I've turned off here. And I'm still explaining things that I'm about to hit enter. And what's going to happen? Right, it disabled it. Now, after I disabled it, notice the copy kept going, right? So the client, oblivious to this, just keeps blasting the data, and it's now connected to node 1. So the TCP socket's been torn down from node 3, now connected to node 1, and that copy just kept going, right? Which is really quite cute. Okay, that's enough for that demo, so I'll just go on to the next demo, because we don't have a lot of time. But what happens if you do something nastier? And instead of doing an administrative failover, I'm now going to do the same sort of thing. It's the same setup. It's doing the X copy, you know, from a client, right? But I'm going to do the equivalent of pulling the power plug on this node, okay? So no warning at all. So I'm going to grab the power plug, pull it out. Now, because I was in Australia, it was hard to reach the power plug in Germany. What I do is something the equivalent of that, which is under Linux, you can echo a B to proc sys request. That does an instant CPU reset, right? No sync, no nothing. The CPU goes, boom, and it's dead, right? So that's what I'm going to do. Echo B to proc sys request, and it's the very thing you do not want to do on a live production system, right? While it's copying data to and from that system over Samba. Okay, and go. Now it's going to take a bit longer because we expect after I do the B, I'm going to switch back to the console to watch it. So after you hit enter, you'll see it flick immediately back to the status display showing the CTDB status being updated. Okay, and I'm explaining. I did a very long explanation in this movie. Come on, hurry up. Yeah, I know. So it's going to take a little while because the CTDB has got to notice the node's got to go away, and the file system has got to notice that the node has gone away. And it's got to be extremely careful that it does know the node has definitely gone away. Otherwise, if two people take over at the same time, you're in real trouble. So, okay, there it goes. And it's done it now. So it's going to take about 12, 15 seconds. Who's counting? So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, disconnected. So CTDB has now noticed, okay, it's gone, that node, right? And because, of course, packets just stopped coming. It could have been a delay on the network, right? I had to be very sure. And then the file system had to notice that, okay, and it's got to do a GPFS clustered file system, takeover, etc. And all the locks had to be re-established. And then the copy can actually keep going, right? Yep.
Does it also work for the shell, or is it basically just because Xcopy is a little bit more aggressive?
It works for some programs, only some. Now, that's okay, that one's finished. So that's a really good point. This is over the SMB protocol. And the SMB protocol is awful for this stuff, right? Because unfortunately, the Windows XP SMB client does not do a completely transparent reconnect to the application. The application, in this case, xcopy.exe, when it got disconnected, reconnect, the application got an error, which is horrible. The application got an error, then the application retried, and as soon as it retries the operation, the redirector does the appropriate thing and re-establishes it to what it thinks is exactly the same server. Now, it works for things like Xcopy, it works for some other applications, but if you're in the middle of saving a file in Word, halfway through the data going down to the disk, you'll get an error box up on the screen. Yuck. Right, you've got to click OK. When you click OK, it then continues and it's all happy. Right, but there's a darn dialogue box that comes up. Yep.
That's what we've got to fix.
That's what we've got to fix, exactly. Right, and SMB2, right, the talk that we got from Thomas on SMB2, one of the key features is the persistent file handles. What that does is that moves the error handling from the application layer, from xcopy.exe, down into the kernel on the client, right, which is where it should have been in the first place. In NFS, okay, when you go NFS failover between, we've had this for donkey's years, the application doesn't get an error, right? It just does it down at the kernel level. NFS had this for years, and I just, it's so looking forward to finally Windows being able to do this in the SMB client. Yep.
On the administrative shutdown, when you sort of did it manually on CTDB, do you actually recreate a TCP stream with identical TCP sequence numbers?
Or No. We don't do any sequence number stuff. I mean, the cost, you'd need hardware to do that, specialized hardware. And these are bulk standard X series, x86-64 blades, right? And the costs in doing the sequence number synchronization is way too high. So no, what it does is, but if we just did it with the normal IP failover, it would be far too slow. Okay, so we do something in between. And I've got some slides that demonstrate the packet flow. We do a thing called a TCP tickle-ack, which is this trick that we use where we construct ACK packets in user space to cause fast resets and failovers of TCP sockets. That's why that was quick. Otherwise, you can be waiting for if the client has just issued a read request, right, and the server's then the client is expecting the read response to come back, the client might wait minutes or hours or whatever, depending on the keeper lives and stuff, before it gets that. The server can't do anything at that point to make the client, retry that read request and re-establish the connection. So what we do is we do distribute the knowledge of the TCP endpoints around the cluster. So every TCP connection is known about by every node in the cluster. And when a node takes over from another node, it has the list of all the TCP endpoints that were established on the previous node, and it can construct a ACK packet in user space with an invalid sequence number fires it off at the client. The client then, of course, TCP standards, sends back a SYN saying, basically saying, that wasn't the right sequence number, this is the right sequence number. The server then says, oh, now I know what the sequence number was. The client's just told me. So it constructs a reset, right? So we're basically storing the state of the sequence numbers in the client. Okay, so we construct a reset packet back to the client, and it then does, the failover happens in a fraction of a second rather than, you know, hours or whatever. Yeah.
We also do it in order to short-circuit
the TCP transmission timers. Yeah, that's right. Short circuits, it's just TCP hackery, you know, IP level hackery, and it really works well, and it makes a huge difference to the usability of this stuff. Otherwise, it works well if they're doing a write, right? If they're halfway through a write, it'll work, okay, because they'll send a retransmission. If they're waiting on an ACK of an outstanding TCP packet, the client will send a retransmission and it'll all fail over fast. But if they're not waiting on a packet at the time, they're not waiting for an acknowledgement at the time when the failover happens, then it'll just could take 2 hours, right? Or you could go and start updating the registry and all the Windows clients in the organization to change the keep alive times, and it's a mess. So these chick-a-lacks were a big win. Okay, so a couple more demos. Which one shall I do? Snapshots showing you GPFS snapshots showing up, or I could show you file notify stuff. Maybe I'll just show you snapshots and we'll leave off the demos. So GPFS, because this is quite cool. So GPFS has some really neat snapshotting stuff. You know, you just go snapshot, and you can create snapshots in a blink of an eye, right? You've got this 100 terabyte or, you know, petabyte file system, and you go snapshot, right? And a snapshot is like an instantaneous copy of the state, copy on write, obviously, and that way you can sort of do instant backups from, and of course it's all on RAID and thing underneath. It's neat stuff. So what I'm doing here is I'm again connected to this same SOUT cluster, you know, the very patient SOUT cluster that I'm abusing here, and I'm just showing a file, and notice that the file currently says version 1 of the file when I typed it, okay? And then going over here, I show what snapshots are present and when they were taken on this cluster, MMLS snapshot, and notice these dates and these times and all these names and things here, okay? And then what we do is we give a bit more commentary, and then we go and edit the file and change the file, and we break it. We change it to version 2. In other words, we make some, you know, bad edit or whatever. And so I'm going to change this to version 2 of the file, and then we're going to get there. And once after we've saved this, we're going to suddenly say, oh no, we needed the old version of the file back, right? And so what the user can then do, notice it's the user, not the administrator, the user can go and browse in Windows Explorer and bring up the view of the data on this server, right? And chug, chug, chug. And he sees this previous versions tab he clicks on previous versions, and there's all the previous versions, the old snapshots, and he can double click on a particular version and he starts viewing the file system at an earlier date. So rewinding in time the file system. Okay, and there's the file system running at an earlier date up there. Notice the date is shown. It's quite cute, that display, I think. And then we can go to the test file here and we can open the previous version, and I'm going to open it with a select program. See, I'm not much of a Windows user. I don't have things set up right to choose the application. Right, opening it with Notepad. And version 1 of the file, so we've got the previous version. So you can basically walk around and browse your file system back in time. And the great thing about this is it reduces the administrator overhead of users ringing up and saying, I've lost my file, I need yesterday's, you know, last week's, whatever. You say, learn how to use previous versions, it's all there. And they can just go and find themselves and use the Explorer and stuff, and it's really neat. We've had this in Samba for a while, but this is now exposed into GPFS snapshots and potentially into other snapshotting systems, and it's a bit more efficient than it was in previous versions. Yeah, Thomas?
What's the integration level trying to avoid so that you sort of snapshot files that are right in the process of being written, so that you end up with inconsistent images in your blocks?
The snapshots there, There isn't one at the moment. So what Thomas is asking is about, say, Microsoft Access or Word or something is halfway through writing a file when you create the snapshot. And is there some sort of quiescence where it tells, it ensures that there are no files being actively written, all files are closed or whatever? That's commonly done with some applications when you're doing snapshots. We don't have a way to hook into that, and we don't know, because we don't know the boundaries of those sort of transactions being done by the Windows clients.
So for the client applications, of course, there's no way of knowing, as you described. For server applications...
That's right. Unfortunately, there is no mechanism to provide
Well, there is one
guarantee.
In Windows.
Yep.
It's called VSS. So for server applications, you can actually, when you coordinate your snapshots by sort of asking for a VSS sort of quiescent point, you get like all the applications to dump their stuff out.
But so how would we then communicate back to the application? So
that's the thing. You can basically tickle the server to get it to sort of quiesce, and then you can take your snapshot on the file system.
Okay. We do? So TSM, but we need to actually integrate it. The applications running on the Windows clients need to know about this stuff. There needs to be a communication channel back to that.
For the server applications, that channel exists.
Oh, for the server applications, fine. There are mechanisms. There's a standard mechanism in the quiescence stuff in the VFS layer in Linux, but there's no linkage between that and what the state of the client applications running Word on a Windows box talking across the SMB protocol.
The way to think about it, if you run, let's say, SQL on a box and you use like SMB as a store, then you can sort of get SQL to quiesce.
The APIs to do that, we don't expose them, but do exist on Linux in the VFS layer, right? And in fact, when you use snapshots onto something like the XFS file system on Linux, that happens automatically. There's an up call from the block layer up to the file system, and then that can propagate. Anyway, we maybe sort of demo and things, and I might need to see a sniff of how it works in your thing. And okay, good. But that is quite interesting, because at the moment, I think that is an area that really could be improved. Okay, so what does Clustered Samba do? Clustered Samba provides highly available all active file serving. Alexander has already explained the concept of all active and why it's so important. Very scalable performance, support for snapshots, offline files, hooks for managing other cluster services. So you can extend CTDB to clusterize FTP, Apache for web stuff, clusterizing NFS. So the SOFS product does all that integrated already, and it clusterizes a whole lot of these other services, so you get completely coherent access between your NFS clients and your SIFS clients, all spread across the cluster with failover, you know, with all the different protocols at the same time, which is really quite neat. Okay, active passive. The common solution for most robust NAS in the past is the Stoneth method, where basically you have, you know, the active node and the passive node, and you kill off the when a node stats aren't healthy, you shoot it in the head to ensure it's completely dead, because you really don't want it, you know, doing any more. And then the passive node takes over. And this is terrible. It's horrible stuff, because the admin has to pray that this hot spare that hasn't been used for a month is going to work. And if it doesn't, then, you know, the admin gets very unhappy. So all active, all of the nodes are serving all of the files all of the time. And so when you're failing over stuff, you're failing over to a node that was already serving another 1,000 users, you know it's working because those other 1,000 users were happy. So very different scenario. So CTDB features, this is sort of the features I talked about last year. This IP failover TickleAct stuff I just described very briefly there. I've got a slide about it later. It's a simple database API. It provides a bunch of protocol hooks for other protocols, protocol extensions. So what's new? I mean, you saw this last year. Since last year, we now cluster persistent databases as well as non-persistent databases, and that required a change in the cluster database protocol to support things like ParseDB, SecretsDB, that sort of thing, so that when you do last year in the demo, I may not have pointed it out, but it was what I did was to do the join, you had to join each node of the domain separately, each node of the cluster separately to the domain, because the join information was stored separately on each node, because we didn't have clustered persistent databases which were, you know, coherent across the cluster. We now have that, which means you do a net join on one node and all the nodes, you know, are updated, net leave on one node and all the nodes are updated, etc. You know, any of these sort of changes to any of the persistent information, the secrets database, the password database, etc., is coherent across the cluster, which is really how things obviously should be. We just didn't have it. Yep.
I don't think you pointed out that SOFS and CTDB, it is one machine account for the entire cluster.
Yes, yes, yes. It's one machine account. It is the one machine in the cluster. Look in Active Directory, there's just the one machine account. It appears as the one machine in the cluster. It's not four separate joins, right? But previously, you had to actually have the information stored separately in slash etc. on each node. Now, the information is stored in this clustered database, and it's because we couldn't persist clustered databases previously that we couldn't do this before. Single cluster IP. This is a really cute feature that Ronnie did, where now you can have the whole cluster having one IP address, right, rather than an IP address per node. Now, generally, what you want is one IP per node and doing DNS round robining between the nodes. But if you want to, you can make the cluster present a single IP address to all of the clients. And what happens is incoming packets come into just one of the nodes, and the kernel on that node redistributes the packets across all the nodes in the cluster, right, incoming. But the outgoing packets go direct from the nodes in the cluster. So for a read-heavy workload, it's beautifully parallelized, flowing out, looks like just this single IP on the server, and gets really great performance with all of the 10 gig e-cards or whatever running in parallel out to the clients. With a write-heavy workload, it's not as good because you've got a bottleneck of that single or bonded, usually it's in bonding or whatever, 10 gig e-card on the incoming. But it is an interesting scenario for people who want the cluster to appear as just one IP address, right? And there are some applications that users have asked, some customers have asked for this sort of thing. It's quite an interesting feature. Snapshots are exposed, as I showed you. Offline file support integration, that was quite a tricky one. The Windows applications are notoriously impatient. When they do a read, if you don't answer their read in 20 to 30 seconds, they'll give up and fire an error. What we needed to do was we have to support this offline file bit. We have to map from the TSM, the Tivoli Storage Manager, other offline hierarchical storage manager, map to the offline bit in Samba, present that offline bit to the Windows client, and then do asynchronous IOs for offline files. So the end result is now that you can just sort of, if you bring up a directory of the files are offline, the little clock symbol shows on it in Windows Explorer, so you know it's offline, right, rather than the normal icon. Because it can't read the icon because that's in the file and that's offline. So it shows the little clock instead, right? And when you double click on the file, there might be a couple of minutes wait while the tape robot fires its arm around and goes and loads a cartridge and fires it back and starts reading the data. But while it's doing that, all the other applications running on that client against the server keep going, right? It doesn't clag up when you're fetching back an offline file that might take a couple of minutes. So that was quite tricky to get that right, and it's an amazingly delicate area, offline files. Persistent databases, I've already described those to some extent. Single IP support, I've described those to some extent already, and I know we're running low on time. Snapshots are exposed. I've shown you a demo of that. The demo should basically give you an idea of how that works. Offline files, I've described that to some extent. Gosh, I'm skipping through quick now. Samba versions. People asked about this in a previous talk about which Samba version. The clustering started in Samba 4.0. IBM decided to create a product around this, and we needed the most stable version of Samba, and we didn't want to be dealing, we didn't want to have the dual task of getting Samba 4 to production ready at the same time as adding, getting the clustering production ready, everything else. So we backported the clustering to Samba 3.0 so that the file sharing portion of it we just knew was extremely stable. So that's what's in production. All the production installs of clustered Samba now are based on Samba 3.0, a special branch of 3.0, which is on ctdb.samba.org, right? All public, of course, all under the GPL. It's now also been ported to Samba 3.2. So the 3.2.0 release, which is very, very soon now, will have all the clustering support. And future versions of the IBM product are also going to be based on 3.2 and then moving to 4.0 into the future, right? Which, so we're working in parallel actually on all three trees, which is a little tricky at the moment, but anyway, that's how things worked out. Scaling results. Here's a few scaling results. people have done clustered Samba for years. There's a chapter of a book on, you know, in using Samba, or I've forgotten what the book title was. It's got this whole chapter on clustering Samba, and it says all you do is you stick the TDBs on the cluster file system and hey presto, it works. And it does work for some very small value of works. And that small value is this. This was a performance testing we did, right, where a one node test got 95 megabytes a second. You throw two nodes in the cluster, the overall performance, the aggregate performance across the cluster dropped to 2.1 megabytes a second, right? So add more nodes and it gets slower, okay? And the more nodes you add, the slower it gets, right? That was the scalable clustering that people used to do with this stuff. This is the results we're getting now, right? 109 megabytes a second with one node, 210 with two nodes, three, and the reason it's tailing off up here is our disks are just running out. We only had 100 or so disks behind this thing, right? We didn't have enough spindles. Yeah.
Linear scaling.
Yeah, we can get really linear scaling. That basically, architecturally, there isn't any reason why this just can't keep going up. And we have measured 1.7 gigabytes a second through a decent sized cluster with decent disk backend, et cetera, aggregate throughput. Which, as far as we know, that's, you know, pretty much as fast as anyone has ever demonstrated an SMB1 server. So really quite pleased with that. I wish I had the video of that Ronnie's got. You could ask Ronnie to show it to you later. But I think your video shows the admin and root passwords, doesn't it? You type them accidentally.
But it also shows that is 1.6, 1.7 gigabytes sustained.
Yeah.
Single share, single IP address.
That's right, single IP address. Yeah, so the whole cluster is a single IP and with a single share. So what do you need? Okay. Sorry?
How many clients?
Ronnie, how many clients did we have in that test?
It was 64, lots of threads. I had 64 threads. No.
64
clients, 16 threads on each client.
Yeah, that's right. I think there was like four Windows, multi-core Windows boxes, each of them running sort of 16 copies of the read frames.
Yes.
So there were 16 threads on each of the clients. And the clients had, were they InfiniBand adapters or was it 10 gig E? What were the clients?
I think that was 10 gig E.
10 gig E, yeah. We've got it in the video anyway.
But with 1.7 gigabyte was essentially when the SAN backend, the InfiniBand backend was bogged down.
Right.
We didn't have a very
the disks,
good...
Getting, I really sympathize with the using the RAM disks you guys were doing, right? Because just getting a big enough disk subsystem to actually stretch this stuff is really tricky. But we were using real disks there, but we had a fair number of them.
Well, if you get large center, is reproducing the results from running
Yes, that's, yeah. Okay, so you guys want to try it, right? It is ready for you guys to try. You'll need a Linux cluster, obviously. You need lots of fast disk, okay? Don't bother this. If you've got like one disk on each node and this sort of thing, just use an ordinary Samba install. This is when you've got a serious disk subsystem that you want to go to the trouble of setting up a Samba cluster. So you've got a real SAN, you've got hundreds of disks running out of time. You need a cluster file system, as I've said. CTDB.samba.org gives you all the things you need to know about your cluster file systems. There's a wiki, there's an IRC channel. If you want a supported version, all packaged, you know, support, etc., rote management, all of that, then go to the one from IBM, the SOFS product. This is build your own on top of GPFS. Go to CTDB.samba.org and you should be all set. So, thank you.
Thank you, Andrew. Probably open questions can be answered during lunch.